Hi and welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner with you on this first week in May. Today, two quite different kinds of stories. In the second half of the hour, we head to the mining town of Broken Hill, circa 1981, to hear about a David and Goliath-like battle over the right to work, when one young woman took on, rather ironically, the town's all-powerful unions. That's up against the barrier soon. But we're kicking off the program today with a new five-part oral history series about everyday life in Australia, spanning across the last half of the 20th century through the memories and reflections of three different generations, those born in the 1930s, the 1950s and the 1970s. What are the changes and perhaps the continuities in life for Australians born four decades apart? Today, in Program 1, we hear memories of childhood, from those shaped by World War II through to the experiences of those who were children in the 1980s, the decade which heralded in the digital age, the technology-driven phenomenon which is arguably altering the nature of human society in radical and irrevocable ways. Here's Part 1 of Australian Generations, Beginnings.
So I was born in Coburg on the 18th of November 1930. My father's name was Frank and my mother's name was Violet.
I was born in Melbourne at the Mercy Hospital in East Melbourne. I'm the oldest of four children. We lived in Eltham North.
I was born in Royal Melbourne Hospital, 5th of November 1958. I'm Goodnich Mara. I'm from the Goodnich Mara clan, or the Goodnich Mara tribe. So I'm born in Melbourne, but I do know where I'm from in terms of my history.
I happened to be born in a refugee camp in Italy, in Piacenza. So I have very little linkage with my siblings who grew up in where my family came from.
Well, I was born in Flemington in Melbourne at St Rowan's Private Hospital, which I believe is still there, not far from what was the Flemington Post Office. But I left Melbourne very early on.
I was born in Footscray Hospital. My parents lived in Tullamarine. They grew up in Footscray and they moved to Tullamarine and set up this an acre and a half lovely big block of land on what used to be an old farm. My sister was born 4 years later, so there's just the two of us, the two girls, me and Sue.
Born in Melbourne, in Moreland, in fact. 54, going on 55 at the moment, and the oldest of six children.
My parents' friends recall that when I was born, Dad drove home from Kerrang and couldn't wait to get home to tell everybody that he had a daughter. So I was a bit of a princess after the two boys. And then they had my next brother was Ian. And then my sister Diane.
I was born in my parents' house in Swan Hill, in the main street of Swan Hill. My father was the manager of the Conn's soft drink factory, and my father worked very hard, long hours at that. But my mother never worked.
So Mum was a traditional lady. She only went out to go shopping, or she went out visiting with her husband. So she was, you know, in the home. She was happy that was her role.
My father, who had gone overseas during the First World War, contracted TB and was quite sick when he came back. And he was sick for quite a number of years, but in 1935 he died and I was 5 years of age.
My father worked full-time, but my mother went... I was the first child and she went back to work probably when I was 3 months old, doing night shift. So it was never just one income. Obviously, Mum would have taken time off each time she had one of the kids, but she always went back to work. And then once we got to Bendigo, she still worked probably part-time, I would say. And then once we were all established in school, I think she probably would have gone to full-time work.
Dad was a milkman, and Mum was looking after all those kids, and you know, life was pretty good.
My mother's name was Mary Teresa, and my father was Francis Xavier. And one of the youngest men in the Victoria Police Force to win the Valour Badge.
The earliest knowledge I really have of Dad, I suppose, would be the apprenticeship he served with the railways. It wasn't until fairly recently that I found out that it was an electrical trade that he was following, because he used to always attempt his own sort of wiring projects at home, which I discovered the last time I saw the house, some particularly dodgy ones of that.
I grew up with my father being totally employed. He'd work 6 days a week with the Border Works, and Sundays he had the reputation in our neighbourhood of doing the concreting. So he was working 7 days a week.
She worked close by. She worked in Reservoir. At the time it was a shoe and boot manufacturing complex. She'd walk to work because it was always very close. And the hours suited her because she left for work only probably 15, 20 minutes prior to we did for school, and she would be home around that same time that we would return from school.
So I think for a year, year and a half or something, I don't know, after they were married, she still worked. And then, you know, once the baby was in the offing, she stopped. And she didn't go back. And so she kept busy with the Mother's Club at school. She was really, really active in the Mother's Club. She would type things for the teachers and, you know, do all sorts of stuff like that. Used to constantly typing stencils for the photograph machine and doing her own, the religious instruction things. And the CWA and, oh, she'd help out with the brownies. Yeah, she was just the volunteer for everything.
My mother was a teacher trained. And in those days, so I'm talking in the 40s, as part of the contract, they had to go to the country. Not one female teacher that went to Quambatook got out. They all married farmers. I have a recollection of my mother, you know, not enjoying it, she, hating the small town, hating the farm, hating the isolation. But she embraced it, you know, because everybody else was the same. All these women had come from other places, and were now, they would call them farmers' wives in those days. I think they call them farmers now. And she was a teacher, and once she married, she had to stop teaching.
My father was a teacher, so we moved to Kyabram, and my earliest memories of that Goulburn Valley town, which is the fruit trees and the channels, which I remember yabbing in, and had a terrific time.
I have exquisite memories of FNQ.
Yes.
I have memories of going to a tap, because it was my job to empty the night pot. So I'd empty it in the out in the grass and the bush. Then I'd go to a tap. You know those old-fashioned taps? I crank it, and these tiny, tiny little green frogs about the size of my little fingernail would come out of the water and run around in the pot. I remember that. I remember the thunderstorms and the wet season, where you'd be standing here and there's bright sun and it's hot and stinking, and in the distance where the hills were, you'd see the black cloud of rain coming.
My brother, Frank, who's 2 years younger than I, saved me. I would be nearly four and he'd be nearly two at that time. My mother had gone across the channel to the neighbour's farm to buy milk, which she did every day, and Frank and I were playing in the yard, and there was a small snake there, small tiger snake, and Frank, who was very small, grabbed the broom and beat it. Now, a snake is a cold-blooded animal, and although it's actually dead, it writhes and moves while it's still warm. And the yard was very warm, so it kept wriggling, and he kept belting it till the head fell off the broom. And I thought afterwards, well, he's my hero, and he saved my life from the snake.
I think my earliest memory is actually sitting in the pram with my brother, who is, he's just under 1 year younger than me, so he's 11 months, 3 weeks and 1 day younger than me. And I can remember sitting in the pram in the toddler seat with him as a baby kind of lying underneath me. So I must have been about 15 months old, I think.
I can remember, and I would have probably been, I don't know how old, having my tonsils out. I can still remember the anaesthetic coming down on my face. In those days, my two brothers had had their tonsils out, and then I had my tonsils out. And we were in a country town, and the story goes that the community always knew how well off your parents were, because if the children had appendix and tonsils out, they were well off. If they just had tonsils out, they were okay. And if the kids had nothing out, they were poor.
The earliest memory, you probably laugh at this, was my first day at school. I went to the Convent of Mercy in Nicholson Street, Fitzroy, right? I couldn't understand why my mother, like all mothers, they take the child first time to school, right? She never. My brother took me up on a bike, Fitzroy Street, Fitzroy, we used to live, rode me up there. Since I got into the entrance, he dumped me. And all I could see was this figure of this nun, and she looked like a pelican. I shouldn't laugh. I was horrified because I'd never seen a nun before. She was in the black. I ran home. My brother took me back 3 times. I was terrified. I was only 7 at the time, and I remember running home, and Mum said, put her on the bike, take her back again.
My father's father, my grandfather, I can always recall that he used to wear a white shirt and black trousers, and he always had a white Panama hat on, and he had a very large moustache. And the moustache, of course, was always white because he was a gentleman of senior years at that time. But I didn't realise at the time, I could never understand in the heat of summer why he was always dressed with long-sleeve shirts on. And I always saw him like that. And I didn't find out until later, as I said, because he was a man that went through the Boer War and was in India. And all his upper body was fairly heavily tattooed. But I never saw it. He never showed anybody.
I can remember one of the things I got for the 6th birthday was a Meccano set to show that Dad could be proud of me. I made this toast rack thing, and I remember making some toast and pushing the toaster down to Mum and Dad to have in bed for that thing there. But then it was the same day. My memory was the same day that I must have felt rather cold. So like a lot of little boys, it might be girls too, but I think mainly boys, I started playing with matches.
Oh, yeah.
So I went outside, and there was this great tall palm tree growing out in the front garden of the place, which is actually the... Dad wasn't the headmaster, but it was we living in the headmaster's residence, and just with a bit of the furry stuff on the side of the palm tree. So I set fire to that, and it was all right. I put it out, and then I set fire to it again, and of course went straight up, and it ruined all the new paintwork on the headmaster. So I don't know why I didn't get a hiding over that one, but.
My parents wanted to have something different. Actually, they were about 60 years ahead of the trend, because they rented a farmhouse and we all moved out to a farmhouse 3 miles out of town. My father believed that you should sleep with lots of fresh air, so the main house, which was old-fashioned with a veranda all the way around and a passage down the middle, and we had had 2 bedrooms, a sitting room and a dining room. And part of the veranda was wired in, and we had one section where my parents and my little brother slept. My sister and I had the front bedroom, and then we had a big concrete room, went from the veranda to the kitchen. We had a huge kitchen, and the maid had part of that wired in. She had her own bedroom there, and we had this long, narrow concrete brick room which had a long narrow table with a bench behind and chairs each end, and that we had most of our meals there as a family.
was a masonette double-storey place in the front, and then there were four other flats behind that, but in different levels. It would have been really a two-bedroom place and a sort of dining room area and your kitchen and your lounge room, but we, at one stage, we had cousins and that living with us, and wanted to get away from their parents, and Mum was quite kind, and we'd, that dining room area we converted into a bedroom at one stage. I mean, it was never a dull moment for as far as people were concerned, either friends or relatives calling in.
In the dining room, there was the, where we used to eat there, you know, was a big room, and one side of the wall was a built-in, in those Victorian eras, you know, houses, the two big doors, glass doors, and Mum used to have all her, her good dinner sets and all. And then we had the old-fashioned kitchen cabinet, you know, with the lead light. She used to have a safe, a wire safe, you know, like a wire. You put all the vegetables in and all that. And then we had the ice chest. It was a good one, modern one.
The front of the house had a one of those typical old crinkly wire chest-high fences with a huge hedge that overgrew that. And I used to love the hedge because it gave us an immense amount of privacy. Once through the very wide front door that these houses came with them, you had the main bedroom on the right-hand side as you walked in. That remained the main bedroom for the entire time I knew the house. On the opposite side was, like I said, the front sitting room, which within a very short time became my sister's bedroom. That had beautiful double glass doors. I remember that opened onto what we called the dining room or the lounge. It was just where we sat. It had a big open fireplace, and you could have formal dinner occasions in there as well. That was always nice on a cold winter's night, toasting yourself in front of the roaring fire. In the middle of all those, there was the only bathroom, of course, which, in spite of all the other alterations and changes to the house, managed to survive in its almost original 30s appearance. You're getting very close to the back of the house by this stage. There was only a couple of other rooms. There was a small room which had become grandfather's bedroom, and pretty well opposite that was in effect the kitchen. There was a long sort of skinny room with just benches on both sides and a stove in the middle, the sink at the end sort of thing. And beyond that was the back veranda, which got partially built in and had become my bedroom.
There was two important rooms in our house, the kitchen and the TV. The kitchen was the drinking room, and that's where they'd sit around, and on a Friday, Dad would work his ass off all week. He'd bring home a half dozen tallies and just talk and play music. And the television, or the lounge room, was where that was the eating room as well. You know, you'd take your meal in there and watch TV, which I think was, I don't know why we started to do that, because most families, we weren't a big family sitting around the table eating. You take a meal and watch TV.
I can recall having roasts in like a dining area when Mum and Dad had a dining table. If there's a large group of people, you'd sort of adjourn to the sort of they have a back room type thing, and you'd eat there rather than in the kitchen.
Our house was totally Italian. Inside my front door, I was Italian. The music, the newspapers, the way we dressed. When I was little, I just wanted so much my mother to bake English, but I mean Australian food, and I wish we could have a leg of lamb the way that my fellow school kids have. And in fact, my mother once or twice bought a leg of lamb and said, OK, well, here, I'll do it. It just didn't taste the same, because we didn't realise that the Australians were using dripping and we used olive oil.
She could cook too, Mum. Often referred to as offal these days, you know, tripe and lamb's fry, and she'd mix whatever we could afford, but she'd mix up chops and roast and that type of thing. You wouldn't want to have them three, four times a week, but I reckon they'd quite make up a nice meal at the time.
She used to make meat pie, rabbit pie, apple pie, the basic cooking, you know, or a stew or something like that. Bit of lamb. Lamb was pretty reasonable in those days, but she was a wholesome sort of cooking, you know, country-style cooking. We all ate well, you know, vegetable stew. She made beautiful stews.
I remember getting home from school, we used to steam dim sims in the microwave ourselves. Or cereal as an after-school snack, or toast with cinnamon and sugar. That was one of my favourites. Another one Mum did, but I don't think any of us kids ever ate it. She just got it from her childhood, was lettuce with sugar. That would be like a snack to her. Or banana with cream and sugar.
When we were growing up, it was much more the sort of meat and three veg type meals. We used to have spaghetti bolognese a lot, I remember, and the other meal I remember having a lot was she would get chicken Maryland things, and, you know, they would be baked in the oven with, you know, peas and potatoes.
Dinner in our house at the time was always fairly structured because Dad would get home from work and it would probably be around 4:45, 5 o'clock. So by the time he got home, he was fairly famished. So Mum decided that the man of the house is coming in, we'll feed him. He's hungry. So that's what we did. By 5, 5:30, we'd have an evening meal and Avon. And that would always be, in most cases, a hot meal with probably three veg. There'd be peas and beans and mashed potatoes and pumpkin and all that sort of thing, and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts. And it would be a stew, or mainly sausages or rissoles, something that Mum would have made up. And that was all much pretty well the same Monday to Friday. Weekends it was probably different. At some stage on the weekend there'd be a roast, in most cases on a Sunday. That used to be as an evening, but then if relatives were coming over, uncles, aunties, cousins, that would probably fall to a lunchtime roast. On Sundays he was always home, so it would have been a cooked breakfast of some sort. Yeah.
We used to take our billy up and you could put, I don't know how much we used to put in, whatever, and put it under this thing and the milk would come out. And had the lid, take the billy home and or get the milk delivered. The time I got home, I used to drink half the milk. It was so creamy. It was beautiful. And we used to love the ice man used to come around. We used to have the old ice chest. Yeah, one of those, and it was a big deal. Now we've got big ice blocks. Can we have some ice, mister? And you get to pick and follow that. And there was a chap used to come around selling his rabbits and a baker. There was the chap, the rabbits. There was a fruit chap brought round vegetables. It was good in those days. And outside the house in Fitzroy, there was a horse's trough. The old cobblestone lane, it used to be up the back. Yeah, it wasn't that bad. I got used to it, you know.
You've been listening to Beginnings, part one of Australian Generations, a five-part series featuring the memories of three generations born between the 1930s and the 1970s. Next week, memories of school. We spend up to 12 or 13 years of our early lives in them, and in next week's instalment, we hear from those who were kids during the Second World War and who went to school on ponies, to the first generation of school students to use computers in the late 1980s. That's episode 2 of Australian Generations on Hindsight next week. And you're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National. Our next feature is set squarely in the beginning of that decade, which brought forth the computer and the internet, the 1980s, though you could be forgiven in thinking that it belonged to an altogether earlier age. In 1980, if you were a woman who lived in the western New South Wales mining town of Broken Hill, had a job deemed non-professional or non-white collar, and decided to get married, then you could wave goodbye to your employment. The all-powerful and very entrenched union body in the town, the Barrier Industrial Council, had laid down the Married Women and Work ruling decades before. And across those years, it seemed to be pretty much accepted, even embraced by some, in the town. But in 1981, the rock-like power that the Barrier Council had in the town would be shaken to the core when one young married woman threw down the gauntlet over her job. Producer Barbara Lemon, who was born in the year that these events took place, 1981, travelled to Broken Hill to uncover this history. Here's Up Against the Barrier.
But it has been an understanding in Broken Hill for a long time that married women don't work. Why have you decided to stick out?
Because, like I said, I need my my job. And Broken Hill hasn't got a higher rate of unemployment than any other country town.
I was just a 21-year-old. All I wanted to do was work.
This was a frontier town, and the power of the men who ran that frontier town was such that people were extremely worried about standing up to it and rocking it.
If you got married and the wife didn't work, you couldn't get ahead in life. At the hospital, there was quite a few couples living de facto relationships for this reason.
I think everybody thought it was strange at the time, but Broken Hill's a strange place, and you know, the fundamentals of things that we accept here are probably different to what people accept in the cities.
And it wasn't just to keep women down. Women in this town were freer than women anywhere else.
It just happened I was the first one to stand up and say, you can't do this. And I guess what also evolved was I changed it for other women in Broken Hill.
Broken Hill has always been a mining town and a union town. For nearly a century, it's been ruled by the powerful Barrier Industrial Council, or BIC, the peak body for local unions. In 1959, the BIC passed a ruling in response to increasing youth unemployment. Starting in June that year, all unions were to give notice to married women to cease work, and married women would henceforth be debarred from union membership. Their jobs would be open to young people. Over the years, married women in skilled professions gained an exemption from the BIC ruling, but those in hospitality and service industries bore the brunt. For some unions, the married women ruling became official policy. For others, it was an unwritten understanding. Despite this, for two decades, Broken Hill women simply swallowed the ruling, like it or not.
One of the things about the unions in Broken Hill and why it's important to get the history of women out is that it is a very male-dominated town. There's never been a female mayor. And up until the 1981, married women in certain unions couldn't work. And that was brought in with my father and his unionist friends. He always believed that women should have an education, had a role, but he truly didn't think that, you know, he was putting women down or disempowering women in any way.
They had no need to work. They just enjoyed life, had a ball. Because when I came back, you know, for the first few years that I didn't work, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Here I am surrounded by all my friends, and it was like, what are you doing today? Yes, well, I'm finished. I got everything done and the kids are at school. What are you doing? Wonderful stuff.
And if it meant our younger people getting jobs, I mean, there were positions that married women held that probably younger people could work in. And if you didn't want your children to leave, like, you know, there was a great exodus of youth because of working conditions. So I suppose we thought it was a little bit detrimental to the feminist movement and to women in general. But in Broken Hill, we probably thought it was not too bad if it meant that younger people got into jobs.
Now, if a family was in dire financial problems for some reason, they simply went to the union and said, look, you know, we were having some problems, and said, I need to work, and I need to work for 12 months to, you know, to get us free of this, if there's, you know, sickness or some big bills or whatever. The OK was always given.
There was a lot of interest in the welfare of their workers and their families. And a policy was that they did try to make sure that someone like Mum, a widow of one of their workers, would find work. And so within 3 weeks she was cleaning the local mine kindergarten. She finally became the hostess of the zinc mine guest house.
In the media it's always said, it's like, you know, oh, Broken Hill, you know, living in the dark ages and keep the women in the kitchen. It wasn't. The women were never in the kitchen, you know. They were there and... But while the kids were at school, they were out, you know, doing whatever. There were tennis clubs and, you name it, squash clubs and swimming clubs and just clubs where women sat and knitted for the people in Africa and, you know, all that kind of thing. And it was a good life.
When I got married, that was 1956, and I returned to the workforce in 1958. I did see an ad in the paper and applied for it and got it because I was the only... one that had the skill to be a comptometrist.
By the 1980s, 20 years after the union ruling on married women was set down, life in Broken Hill, like the rest of Australia, had changed. House prices and mortgages were up, mining jobs were down, and many couples had begun living in de facto relationships. Still, it seemed, nobody was prepared to openly question the ruling. Nobody, that is, until 1981, when 21-year-old newlywed Janine Whitehair took her employer, the town dental clinic, to court for unfair dismissal.
We didn't notice it, to be honest. We just were growing up, having great fun at school and, you know, growing up in a great place. And it really didn't come to the fore for me until I decided I was going to get married. And then it was like, well, why can't I work? And that's when I questioned it. And then I was actually told by one of the board members that, Janine, if you and Mark live together, you can keep your job. And then I said, well, a ring on my finger and a piece of paper, how does that change? Oh, because you're married and we don't employ married women. But I could live with him and I could continue to work.
And then Janine Whitehair came along and she's a lovely girl too and I really like her.
Long-term resident Heather Powell was Broken Hill's first female union secretary and worked for the Clerks Union at the time of the Whitehair case. Later she became the first woman vice president of the Barrier Industrial Council.
She started work at the dental clinic as an office assistant. So it was a job that, you know, a young girl could do. And when she said that she was being married, they said, well, you know, you've got, you know, so much time after you marry to work, and that said, you have to step down. And I know that she didn't like it. It was all done very quietly, and then suddenly the media in Sydney had it, and there was trouble all round.
I actually got married in November 1980, and I was given notice in July, I think, 81. When I made the inquiry to the Anti-Discrimination Board, they said, well, no, they can't do it. And I said, well, I know they can't do it, but they're going to do it. So the Anti-Discrimination Board just said, right, well, we can't do anything until you're actually dismissed, but we just keep us informed. And Carmel Nyland was the commissioner at the time.
When Janine Whitehair first approached the Anti-Discrimination Board, which was around the time, I think, that she got engaged, and she was working for the town dental clinic, it had been the complaint that I had been waiting for. Ah, yes, this was it. She was articulate, she was clear, she was strong, and she was extremely worried, as women were in the early 80s. She wanted to retain her position and contribute to the mortgage because life had changed and people were moving quickly away from rented accommodation into buying their own homes. And in order to do that in the 80s, you needed two incomes.
In the mid-1970s, Carmel Nyland had been appointed to head up the Women's Coordination Unit under then New South Wales Premier Neville Wran. She later became the Councillor for Equal Opportunity and helped to write anti-discrimination legislation for the state.
By the time of the years that we're talking about, I was President of the Anti-Discrimination Board. With a familiarity with the Premier's department, the kind of interseam networks of the New South Wales government, and a very rudimentary understanding of the influence of the unions and how the Anti-Discrimination Act had been constructed to ensure two things. One, that the Labor Council of New South Wales would remain preeminent in deciding wages, even if the wages were unequal. And secondly, that the township of Broken Hill would continue to be exempt from any industrial award or laws, because didn't we know that Broken Hill was really in South Australia? It wasn't really part of our jurisdiction at all.
One of the union representatives had said to you outright that
these laws don't apply to Broken Hill, is that right?
Yeah, he said the Anti-Discrimination Act doesn't apply to Broken Hill. A whole lot of them did believe that it didn't apply to Broken Hill, and they probably thought I wouldn't go as far as I did.
When she approached us, one of the first things I did was to get a legal opinion, because I'd heard whispers that Broken Hill was not covered by the Anti-Discrimination Act, and using her theoretical complaint was to see if it was covered by the Act as it was written. And below me down it was. June Williams was the officer on duty who took the case. Aaron Moss, of course, who was also involved, went on to become the race commissioner. These are not women to be taken lightly. Not at all. Aaron Moss was made of stainless steel. And the combination of the three of us was like the three amigos, if ever there was one. We were only acting because we had a law to back us up. We were doing our statutory duty. We had a complaint. Talk about a complaint made in heaven. The head of the Barrier Industrial Council had a loud voice, and he and I had a discussion, and you could hear him almost unassisted by telecom down in Sydney. He said to me, "Why don't you come up, girly? See how we do things here." I'd never been called girly before. I didn't know whether to be flattered or insulted. He said, "And I'll take you down a mine." The last woman we took down a mine was Queen Elizabeth II, but she came up again. And I thought, uh-oh. In all of this, there was the veil threat. So I went to see the Premier. He said, "I don't know." I think he was Minister for Police, Ran. He said, "I don't know that we actually cover Broken Hill." Still joking. And I said, "Well, what options have I got?" And he said to me, "Do you know Ian Frickberg at the Herald?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "No, he's take the Herald." That's how come Deborah Hope accompanied me when we actually ended up going there.
Carmel contacted me and mentioned this story. I thought it was extraordinary and would be a terrific case, but also a terrific story. At the time, I was a Sydney Morning Herald reporter. I think I'd been at the Herald only a couple of years. I'd done a one-year cadetship, and I was probably in my third year of employment there, and I was a union reporter, reporting on unions based at the Trades Hall. And it was a really, just to get the context, it was an incredibly lively time. There were strikes all the time. The 38 or the 35-hour week was something that was an aspiration. You know, there were the beer strikes, the postage strikes, the train strikes, all that traditional stuff that we remember rather in the distance. It's quite a different era now, and, well, you know, I suppose in the Hawke government, when they brought in the accord, it became that way in 1983, but this was still in 1981, and it was still a very, very lively industrial scene.
In the Barrier Ranges, Broken Hill, far enough from anywhere to be a law unto itself. A one-industry mining town running on union laws.
Suddenly, there was all this media attention because someone had supposedly stood up to a union. But that's not what I did. I just really don't like the fact that people have misconstrued, and it has been misreported, but I didn't take on the union. I took on my employer.
In Broken Hill, employers and workers have accepted that no union ticket means no job. And there's another, largely unwritten rule. If you're a married woman, you don't work either. Janine Whitehair is a 21-year-old married dental nurse who's taking that rule on. A firm unionist, she's been sacked by a union-run dental clinic without support from her own union, the shop assistants. She has no doubt about the reason.
We had phone calls from the news. Prue Goward rang. I can't remember. There was dozens of them, and I become very intimidated. The phone didn't stop ringing.
Betty Reardon, née Cook, was a friend of Janine Whitehair and in 1981 was working at the Broken Hill Hospital and living with her long-term boyfriend. When the media got whiff of the Whitehair story, they went looking for women like Betty, who were living in de facto relationships, to ask them whether they remained unmarried by choice or as a way of keeping their jobs. For the last half of 1981, the Whitehair controversy had great traction in the media. Here was a pretty young girl taking on a male-dominated union, and in Broken Hill itself, the issue polarised the community.
I think if she doesn't like the union, she should leave Broken Hill. This is a union town, and if we didn't have unions, after their husbands wouldn't have jobs.
If a married woman wants to work, usually a reason for it. I don't know about being bored, but in a lot of homes, the husband may not be a big wage earner.
At the hospital, where in my work area, there was quite a few couples living de facto relationships for this reason.
So it was generally accepted that financially to get ahead, that was the only arrangement. Roughly how many of the women or the girls that you were working with?
It was a lot bigger workforce back then, I have to say, but I would say maybe a third of the people that I work with
were in de facto relationships.
Yes.
Do you stop de facto wives from working ever?
No, I wouldn't.
But you have stopped a married woman from working.
No, we haven't stopped a married woman from working. We say the married woman should continue work until such time as there's a girl to take her job.
Well, it amounts to the same thing.
Oh, not to me.
Where have we stopped a married woman working?
Well,
have we stopped a married woman
working? I've spoken to another dental assistant this morning, apart from this girl, who says that she was asked to stop work. The shop assistants' union-owned policy states that...
That's right. And the reason is proved because of our employment situation. And that, to an outsider, to a person from away, is very hard for you to comprehend. I understand that, and we understand it. But, you know, I think that we owe a duty to the people of Broken Hill to see if we can get as many jobs as we can, irrespective of what they are.
It promises to be a divisive issue for the town, a mining town run by males.
I remember they were doing a segment, I think it was Prue that was doing an interview with Janine outside the dental clinic at the hospital, and we had been told that we were not to do any interviews during work hours. So we were having a look, but in a sneaky way, which we shouldn't have been. And somebody must have pointed me out to Prue because she grabbed my arm and, come on, quick, and I was absolutely petrified. It wasn't a very good interview, I must say, because I was petrified that I'd get caught.
The Broken Hill Hospital is a monument to this. Under union rules, the domestics aren't allowed to work once they're married. So, with full union knowledge, what do some, like Betty Cook, do?
Why do you live with your fiancé?
Because I haven't been allowed to work while I've been married. I've been living with my fiancé for nearly 7 years now.
What about when you have children?
Well, I'm getting married in October.
And then what will happen?
I'm going through with it now, actually.
And what will happen to your job?
Well, I hope to keep it.
What do you think are your chances?
Well, I'm pretty good because I went to a meeting with the ladies that came up from Sydney the other day, so I think it'll be all right.
I had a range of secret meetings. They were at night. They were at locations that were only revealed to me. They were kind of in the back rooms of coffee places or in people's houses. And we kind of slunk around in the shadows. We did very little in daylight.
And I had wonderful support. Even walking down the street doing my shopping, a lot of the girls in town would, you know, oh, how's your case going? You know, I'm living with my partner so-and-so and we want to get married, but we want to see what happens, you know, with your case. It'd take me twice as long to do my shopping because I'd have to give an update as I walked down Argent Street because all these lovely ladies wanted to get married and they all chose to live with their partners and were madly waiting to see the outcome of my case.
In Broken Hill, while Carmel Nyland was advising women like Betty Reardon, journalist Deborah Hope was doing her own research and the two women were careful not to appear to be working in collusion.
I think the idea was that I would
sit separately from her, certainly, and stay in different accommodation. And I think we must have communicated by phone. And I, while she was dealing with union officials, I was going around the town and interviewing people in pubs and on the street and so on about the case and about what they thought should happen and about Broken Hill more generally and attitudes of men towards women working and women towards their jobs and so on. I don't think that I found a real lot of support for the prevailing ruling.
Deborah Hope's article about the union town of Broken Hill would receive national coverage, with a front page spread in both the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. As part of the visit, Carmel Nyland became the first woman to address the then all-male Barrier Industrial Council, the peak body covering all unions in the town.
I had a prepared text, and essentially my approach was, men and women have worked side by side to gain union membership. I was a union member, and I had been a union member all my life, and my union membership was precious to me. So I didn't take it the approach that when a woman said, I do, she was going to lose a job, because they were convinced that only a man could provide economic security, so it didn't go that route. I said, when a woman said I do, she loses the right of union membership. And this was a terrible thing for a labour-oriented social justice town to deny of a woman who had fought beside you for the right of union membership. So it was all dealt with in that way. Now, that particular argument, which is not Einstein stuff, had never been used with them before, and they were prepared to engage on that.
In your meeting with the BIC, did the irony in the fact that the unions were the ones stopping people from working, where a union is designed by definition to fight for the rights of workers, did that irony sort of strike?
No, it didn't. And one of the things they said to me in the Barrier Industrial Council, well, like, what were you trained of? What union are you a member of? And I said, I'm actually a member of the Teachers' Federation, because the PSA was so piss weak at representing women that it had a discriminatory superannuation policy. So I'm a member of the Teachers' Federation. And he said, well, you'd still be able to work here. You know, the Teachers' Federation is exempt. So what are you worried about? He was not able to understand that being a woman, you're one with other women. I was one with those women, understanding how difficult it was for anyone to look crooked in the town, to understand the corrosion of the gossip in the town, to understand the undermining and white-anting that went on if someone crossed the line in some way. I understood that. I didn't have personal experience of it, but I could empathise with it. The men I was negotiating with were unable to empathise with that. Their role was so circumscribed. Those men were in straitjackets, straitjackets imposed by a class and an industrial system which gave them very little room to move.
I remember the time there, the white hair was there, it was time change was happening all around the place, and it was only a matter of time for some people were going to buck the system, and she happened to be the one. But whether we like it or not, the system in Broken Hill, whether it's most democratic or not, worked for the majority of people in Broken Hill.
Bill O'Neill, former president of the Barrier Industrial Council and son of its most famous leader, Shorty O'Neill, who presided over the BIC in 1959 when the Married Women and Work ruling was handed down. Unions in Broken Hill enjoyed the loyalty of townsfolk, but the writing was on the wall for the outdated policies of the Barrier Industrial Council. In July 1981, Janine Whitehead took her case to the arbitration court with the support of the Equal Opportunity Commission. What began as a dispute with the town dental clinic evolved into a landmark case against the BIC with major ramifications.
It was a case which was over quite quickly. There was no dispute. Was she denied the right to work from the moment that she got married? Yes. Did she lose her job? Yes. Did she lose her job because she was a woman? No. She lost her job because she didn't have a ticket, union membership. And if you don't have union membership, you can't work in Broken Hill. So there was legal argument around that, around union membership. Once that was determined by the tribunal, there were considerable other cases. And these cases had a poignancy to them because they were taken by the daughters of one of the key union officials, Mr. Ferry. He had four daughters, I believe, and at least two of them took major cases. So you can see that what's happening is the generation of articulate, strong women committed to the union were saying, you cannot deny me union membership. So they weren't fighting the case about women's right to work. They were fighting the case about women's union membership, and they were the daughters of the Barry Industrial case. It's all over Red Rover when they came up.
The arbitration court found that Janine Whitehair had been sacked as a result of her marital status and that her sacking was in breach of anti-discrimination laws. The finding undermined the policy of the Barrier Industrial Council, which could no longer enforce its ruling on married women with any credibility. After the decision was handed down, Janine Whitehair was reinstated in her job at the dental clinic, complete with back pay. She chose to take up a new job at the local hospital and stayed on living in Broken Hill for the next 25 years.
I wasn't ready at 21 to give up work. I'd only just started. And I didn't like the fact I didn't have a choice. What would I do? I didn't have any burning desire to have children, which I've never regretted. And, you know, without having plans to have a family, what would I do? I wouldn't. Even today, I still couldn't sit home and play ladies.
Some people still believe in the principle that the keep the girls, young girls in Broken Hill, that they give their jobs up, and some didn't. So after the court ruling, it was a matter of choice.
Got this in pocket. Got that all.
The number one key message of all of this is the courage of the women in what they did. To take on their own community, where there are no options, to go against the established behaviour, to be prepared to cope with the ostracisation, to know that they may have to leave town and lose their social support system, their friendship networks. This is enormous courage. Men have the chance of expressing physical courage in war, and in football, and in a whole lot of other games. But real courage is emotional and spiritual courage, and that's what those women had. And that's why they ultimately won. We've got a lot to thank them for.
Up Against the Barrier was produced by Barbara Lemon. Thanks to those who took part, especially Janine Clark and Carmel Nyland. Thanks also to Heather Powell and the women of Broken Hill. And that's where we leave the late 20th century and this journey through the past for today. I'm Michelle Rayner. Look forward to your company on Hindsight next week here on ABC Radio National.